Case number 13-5127. Cause of action, appellant versus National Archives and Records Administration. Mr. Epstein for the appellant, Ms. Connolly for the appellant, Ms. Cole for the appellee.
Mr. Epstein, good morning.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Daniel Epstein, and I represent the appellant, cause of action in this case. Keeping secret those records created and controlled by an agency for the purpose of responding to a congressional oversight request frustrates the purpose of the Freedom of Information Act. There are two key issues in this case well recognized by this circuit. The first is whether the district court erred in failing to segregate those documents in the possession of the archives that were produced to the Oversight Committee, which were subject to the Freedom of Information Act. The second issue is whether the archives, in creating and producing records for the purpose of responding to an Oversight Committee request, effectively created records that were subject to the Freedom of Information Act. On this first issue, that
isn't the real issue whether the records that were transferred to the archives still retain their status as legislative records not subject to FOIA?
Well, Judge Kavanaugh, our FOIA request below dealt with a specific scope, and the scope of that request was not the records transferred from the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission to the archives, but instead those records that were transferred from the archives to the eight congressional offices.
Right, but those records came originally from the commission, right?
That's true, but what is clear in this case is that those original commission records had certain restrictions. In fact, in the arguments below, the archives and the government's position is that they have never violated any of the restrictions placed on records by a donor. Here, those restrictions included restrictions concerning privacy, financial information, all sorts of things that were then ignored when creating new records that were transferred to eight congressional offices. It's very clear that these restrictions were not included in a March 2nd, 2011 letter that was sent to these eight congressional offices. It didn't include the original restrictions placed by former chairman of the commission.
The issue here is whether FOIA gives you a right to these records which originally came from the commission. And I guess from my perspective, the statute, 2108, the Federal Records Act, unlike some of our case law, which has had four-factor tests and two-factor tests and what have you, the statute seems to speak directly to this issue by saying that agencies, including legislative agencies, can transfer documents to the archives but retain the restrictions on the release of the records. Why doesn't that statute just resolve the case?
Well, Your Honor, 2108 also indicates that the archivist, at his discretion, can relax, remove, or impose additional restrictions.
However, right, and the archives has said their discretion, they're not going to exercise their discretion because they have a historical practice of deferring to the wishes of the donor agency in these circumstances. So.
And we look at that argument to suggest that the fact that these records were given to eight congressional offices without any of those restrictions has to be the case that these are records that the agency created solely in responding to Congress, not for an archival purpose. These records were not sent to the Oversight Committee for any archival purpose. They were not sent to the House Financial Services Committee for any archival purpose.
Your argument seems to be that they violated the terms of the restrictions in sending the documents to Congress, therefore they should violate the terms of the restrictions again.
Well, that might be an alternative argument. I think our argument is to simply look at what the government said below, which is that the intent of the donor was never violated, that they haven't exercised any discretion in this case, to suggest that it can only be the case that these were not archival records, which is recognized in their own regulations, but operational records, which is also recognized in their regulations. And therefore, these were records which were created for the purpose of responding to a congressional oversight request, not for any archival purpose. And the archives, more so than any other agency, has the ability to distinguish between those records that are archival in nature and those records that are operational. Here, the archives decided to give these records to eight congressional offices. One of those offices, which posted a substantial number of these records in a report and revealed personal information, revealed financial information. Mm-hmm. And yet the archives had the opportunity to require Congress to abide by the original restrictions on these records, and yet it didn't. So we look at that as to say it's very clear here that the archives exercised a non-archival purpose in producing these records. If it's the case that the government argues that, in fact, these were not, that they essentially violated the intent of the records transfer, then I think that's a different case. But they never argued that below. I think that, again, relates to this question of, you know, what was the scope of cause of action appellant's original FOIA request? And the scope was not for the FCIC, the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission records themselves, but for those records that were produced for the purpose of responding to an oversight request. I think it's also important to note, just on the facts, and as stated in the record below, that the archives had the opportunity to wait until the archivist determined that these were archival records. That happened sometime in late April 2011. But these records were produced to the House Oversight Committee in March 2011, when they were not yet certified as archival. They didn't contain any kinds of certifications, and they didn't contain restrictions. And I think it would very much violate the purpose of transparency if we were to hold that the archives, which more than any other agency has specific regulations about how they dispose of records, how they treat archival records, to automatically say that these records can be archival even if we don't follow our own procedures.
You know the dispute that these were exempt from FOIA before they went to the archives?
So we don't, Your Honor.
Okay. And so what I'm trying to understand is why, if it's, let's just call it a legislative record because it was a legislative commission, why giving the documents to the archives changes the character? Once they go to the archives, aren't they still legislative records?
I agree, Your Honor.
So then when they're produced to a legislative committee, how does that take them out of being a legislative record?
Well, because the archives can produce these records to a legislative committee like the House Oversight Committee or House Financial Services Committees, both which have, in the case of the House Oversight Committee, they have oversight over the National Archives, and the Financial Services Committee was specifically mentioned in the organic statute, the Fraud Enforcement and Recovery Act. But here, the host of restrictions that Phil Angelides placed on these records were essentially not included in the records that were created, copied, and produced to the oversight committees. And they weren't created, copied, and produced for any other purpose than the National Archives acting as a federal agency, responding like any other federal agency would to a request from the House Oversight Committee.
But even if they were transferred to the records were transferred to the archives with no restrictions on them, that is it your position that therefore they're subject to FOIA, even though there were legislative records?
Well, Your Honor, so if the archives uses a form called the SF-258 to transfer mm-hmm. records from a legislative agency to the archives. And it's also important in this case that the legislative agency no longer exists, which means that the archives is the appropriate place for the records. But here, if there are no restrictions placed off the records, the transfer agreement, the terms of that SF-258 indicate that these records are going to be held with the applicable restrictions under 5 U.S.C. Section 552, which is, of course, the Freedom of Information Act, which is to say...
That was crossed out here.
That was crossed out here. And we argued below that has some implications. But here, in terms of the basic question as to how do we treat the records that were sent from the archives to the 8 congressional offices, that question is one where we don't have to specifically deal with the significance of the cross out.
Do you agree, I'm sorry to interrupt, do you agree that if they hadn't been sent to Congress that these records would be exempt from FOIA?
If the question is would these records maintain their legislative purpose? Absolutely.
No, the question was would they be exempt from FOIA?
Well, yes, I mean they would be exempt simply as legislative records. And then the question is if it turns out that, and this was something that we believe the district court erred in by not making a sua sponte determination, which is to say it's now obvious based off what Ranking Member Elijah Cummings put out online that there were records from the SEC, Securities and Exchange Commission, the U.S. Treasury, the Federal Housing Finance Agency within those FCIC records. This court has well recognized that when there are agency records where FOIA applies, the district court has a duty to make a determination that those are segregable. That didn't happen here. These records, there was a clear restriction on these records. Phil Angelides, who was the chairman of the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission, said these records should not be publicly released until 2016. If that was maintained, those records would not be subject to FOIA. In fact, we would contend that the FCIC records in their original form are not subject to FOIA. But it's a separate question, one that this circuit has recognized when a federal agency is responding to Congress, whether those records that are created and produced in response to Congress are subject to the Freedom of Information Act. And what's clear here on the facts is in that transfer letter from March 2nd, 2011, there were none of those original restrictions placed on the records.
I have two questions. You're not arguing that when this staff and commission, according to the Angelides letter, are given access even after they're eliminated, that paragraph that says during this period, that is during the 2 months before they give their final report, even though they've been terminated, access should be given to the members of the commission and to the staff. So you're not arguing when the archives gave those people access, they were violating.
No, Your Honor, and that presents a unique question here, which is the Center for Legislative Archives at the National Archives was required to read and rely upon these records. It was required by Phil Angelides, who was the donor of these records. Our argument is that the control test that should apply is what was the archives' intent with creating and copying and producing these records to Congress, and was it the records that were in the archives' free disposition? And it's clear in telling Congress, you can either return or destroy these records, that archives had free disposition over these records.
Okay, my other question was this. I don't see how this is different, and that's why I want to ask your position on this. Picking up with what Judge Randolph said, if a member of the legislature clearly legislative records gives them to the National Archives and then wants to retrieve them for some reason, are you saying that somehow brings them into the FOIA? And if you're saying no, then how is this different from that?
Your Honor, I believe my time is up.
Go ahead and answer.
Thank you. The Archives actually has specific regulations that apply for when the House or the Senate wants to review those their own records. In fact, when the House or the Senate deposits records to the Archives, those are maintained as congressional records. It doesn't change. The question is, those congressional offices still control those records. Here, it was not the Oversight Committee depositing records to Congress. It was the Oversight Committee requesting records from a commission that no longer existed, and the Archives specifically copying and creating new records in order to respond to that oversight request.
But the records were the records of its own commission that had since been terminated.
That's right, and we have recognized in this circuit that if there is a specific indication by the Oversight Committee, just like in United We Stand, that these records ought not be subject to the Freedom of Information Act, the analysis would be different. But the Oversight Committee never said, when asking for these records, we also understand that these are not subject to the Freedom of Information Act.
Why would they ask that if they're legislative records?
Well, I don't think the Oversight Committee, well, I think the Oversight Committee could easily have done that, just like the Joint Committee on Taxation might deem certain records that the IRS has as responsive to not be to be legislative records that nevertheless should not be subject to FOIA. Here, it is common that the Oversight Committee or any Oversight Committee in Congress will ask for records from an agency, and then the community of FOIA requesters will then look at that as an opportunity to request records from the agency.
But are they legislative records you're describing?
The records that the archives produce to the Oversight Committee, our argument is that these are not legislative records. These are agency records that the archives created in response to a request.
Just so I'm clear, when you say created new records, they made copies of records that had come from the commission, correct?
Your Honor, the record indicates that they made copies. They then reformatted the records. They then distributed them to the eight congressional offices.
Right.
And they did this. The letter from March
2nd. There was no new content added by the archives, correct?
There was no content, Your Honor. But the March 2nd, 2011 letter indicates that not the full set of Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission records were produced. In fact, the Congress, Darrell Issa from the Oversight Committee, asked for just the internal work product, and what archives produced was both the internal work product and those agency records that were part of those files, which is another reason why the archives should have segregated those records in response to our request.
All right, we'll give you some time to reply.
Thank you.
Ms. Connolly? Marie Connolly?
I was just going to reserve my time for rebuttal.
All right. Ms. Cole? I'm not sure that's proper, but.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, I'm Christine Cole with the Department of Justice on behalf of the National Archives and Records Administration. If I understand cause of action's argument this morning, they seem to have conceded their entire case. In response to Judge Kavanaugh's question as to whether or not the records would be exempt from FOIA if they had not been sent to Congress, cause of action's counsel indicated that FOIA would not apply. So the focus now at this stage of this case seems to be on this response of the National Archives to the congressional request for copies, for electronic copies of certain records of the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission. Cause of Action's counsel, it's necessary to clarify some of the statements that he made. For example, and he just conceded that there was no content added. All that the archives did, and this happened within a matter of a couple weeks after the commission was terminated and transferred its records to the National Archives, all the agency did was make electronic copies of it. There was a need to reformat some of them because it turned out that the House of Representatives committees that had requested the records had a non-compatible format. But there was no content, as cause of action has conceded this morning. Nothing was added to it. Now, in reference to, there's been several statements made about a March 2011 letter that the General Counsel of the National Archives sent to the committees when it provided these copies to the committees. Now, this record or this letter is not in the record in this case. It was attached to the opposition to our motion to strike filed by cause of action. However, we have no objection to the court reviewing and considering that letter. And in fact, it's quite helpful and responsive to one of the issues raised this morning by cause of action. The letter specifically advises those committees that the records being provided, and these are electronic copies, again, of the commission's internal work product, says the records being provided are likely to include highly confidential and sensitive information that was provided to the commission and private financial institutions, including but not limited to the following: information concerning active federal law enforcement agency investigations and examinations, public disclosure of which could potentially harm ongoing civil and criminal law enforcement efforts. Another category: confidential and sensitive proprietary information obtained by federal regulatory information. The letter goes on to caution and advise the House committees that there is sensitive material. So the notion that they somehow violated the restrictions in the commission's transfer letter is simply incorrect. And indeed, that letter itself, the letter prepared by Chairman Angelides, specifically refers to public disclosure. That's what the restrictions pertain to. Not disclosure to the very legislative body that created the commission. So this, when the National Archives and Records Administration responded to this congressional request, it was not unlike the many congressional requests that federal agencies throughout Washington get. They were simply providing these copies pursuant to the oversight and other committees' requests. The Class of Actions Council also began its argument by referring to these records are being kept secret. That's not true either, Your Honors. The National Archives and Records Administration has a unique function within the federal government as the permanent repository of the government's most important archival records of all three branches of the federal government. So it has a dual mission. One part of the mission is to preserve what's considered the National Archives of the United States. And I have to digress here to point out that the National Archives of the United States, it's a term of art that refers to the body of all of these important documents from all three branches. That's distinguished from the federal agency that's the defendant in this case, the National Archives and Records Administration, which has its own records. It is an executive agency, and its operational records are, of course, subject to the Freedom of Information Act. But that's distinguished from the Archives of the United States, which is this body of records that is preserved by the agency. The second main function of the National Archives is that it exists to provide public access to scholars and others who want to examine and research these important records of our government. So it's not about keeping documents secret, but what this case is about is not whether these documents will ever be provided or made available to the public. It's about how and when the documents will be made available. And that's governed by the controlling statutes here, and that would be the Federal Records Act, which specifically authorized the Federal Crisis or the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission to impose restrictions, which it did. And under the National Archives and Records Administration's regulations, it honors those restrictions.
Even though the statute seems with defunct agencies to give the archivist discretion and the public interest to release them, I gather by regulation or by historical practice, as referred to in the brief, the archives honors the restrictions in the letter from the now defunct agency.
That's absolutely correct, Your Honor. And I think it bears noting here that when Cause of Action filed its appeal with the National Archives and Records Administration of the denial of its FOIA request, it specifically disclaimed any reliance on that provision. And this is found at page, I believe, A26 in the appendix. It says that provision, section 2108, which gives the agency that discretion, is inapposite. I think that's the phrase that Cause of Action used. So this case is not about whether or not the archivist should have exercised his discretion to disregard the explicit wishes of the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission. It's about whether or not the Freedom of Information Act applies to records that Cause of Action has conceded are created by a branch of the by an agency within the legislative branch of government, a branch of the government that, by the clear terms of both the Freedom of Information Act and well-established case law, going back to Reporters Committee, the Supreme Court's decision, as well as a number of decisions of this court and other circuits, have held that the provisions of of the Freedom of Information Act that say it doesn't cover the courts and Congress, the law is clearly established, and I don't understand cause of action to challenge this, that the entire legislative and judicial branches are encompassed within those particular provisions.
Is Katz the only case in this circuit that dealt with a FOIA request to the National Archives?
No, Your Honor. The Riccio case is another one, Riccio versus Klein. And that's a case that is very similar to what went on here. The court there ruled that these involved transcripts that were made of the Watergate tapes, I guess, by the Watergate Special Task Force. And at the conclusion, when that task force was disbanded, the transcripts were provided to the National Archives. Now, at the time, I believe it was the Presidential Recordings and Materials Act governed those particular materials, and this court held that FOIA didn't apply because there was this other statute which governed how and when those tapes and transcripts, rather, would be disclosed. Well, this is a very similar situation in that the Federal Records Act and the NARA regulations basically are the laws that govern the disclosure of the records the cause of action are seeking. Again, this is not about keeping these records secret indefinitely. It's about honoring the restrictions that were placed on these records by the legislative agency that created them. It's about complying.
That was, what, released in 2016?
Yes.
And what if the agency had said never release them? Then it would be about keeping the records secret forever.
It would be, and that obviously would be a much more difficult situation, and it might well be a circumstance that would call for the exercise of discretion of the archivist. But that's clearly not what's involved here. In fact, there's
the archivist could have refused to accept them in the first place under such a restriction. Is that correct or not?
I believe that's true.
Because it says if he concurs in that sentence in the Records Act. I don't know how that's historically done.
Yeah, I can't give you a definitive answer on that. But it's clear that in this case, there's, first of all, a substantial amount of the material is publicly available of the work that this commission did. There's almost a 700-page report that to Congress, which is publicly available. A substantial amount of other information is out there on a website that's maintained by Stanford University. And in less than 2 years, requesters can come to the National Archives and request the documents that the commission asked to have restricted.
If a legislative record or a judicial record goes to the archives without any restriction, say, for example, a Supreme Court justice passes away, and the estate is not sufficiently attuned to any of this, and all of the conference memos and everything else goes to the archives without any restrictions. Does that mean that they're automatically publicly available?
I can't give you a clear answer on that, Your Honor, because it's governed by a different statutory scheme. The actual records of the Congress itself and the Supreme Court are treated differently under the Federal Records Act. My understanding is that the personal records of judges and justices are not usually submitted to the National Archives. So I'm not sure how the National Archives would treat the particular hypothetical that you pose, but I do know it's the Supreme Court is not considered a federal agency for purposes of the Federal Records Act. It's a different statutory scheme that comes into play.
Whereas this agency was considered a federal agency under the Federal Records Act. Right.
Yes, Your Honor, that's by definition,
right.
And that's in, I believe it's
2901, I think.
Yeah, section, subsection 14, specifically says that federal agency, as used in that statute, in contrast to the statutory definition in FOIA,
right.
That says that it encompasses the entire legislative and judicial branch. Court has no further questions. We ask that the decision of the district court be affirmed. Thank you, Your Honor.
Ms. Connolly, before you begin, I owe you an apology. When I didn't see your name on the brief of cause of action, I thought you were representing someone else, and in fact, you've done everything extremely properly. You asked for divided argument, and that one of you would reply, so don't let it affect your argument. Take your full 3 minutes.
Thank you, Judge. May it please the Court. I want to begin by drawing your attention to the fact that these records were deposited under 2108. As you just discussed, these records were federal records under the Federal Records Act. The FCIC was an agency under the Federal Records Act. For records that are deposited in this manner, the National Archives cannot release these records to Congress by its own regulations unless there's a subpoena. I say this because I draw your attention to...
This is the same question I asked before, but what difference does it matter if they allegedly didn't abide by the restrictions by sending them to Congress, allegedly? What difference does that matter make for this case? Because this is a FOIA suit, and the question is whether the Federal Records Act specifically speaks to the issue here, and it seems to. And so how can we here ignore the restriction that was placed on the records?
Your Honor, when the records were deposited with the National Archives, they were deposited with a FOIA form, and the presumption was that the Freedom of Information Act applies. And if the Freedom of Information...
No, they crossed that out.
But if it doesn't apply, the regulations and the statute require that the depositor cite legal authority to justify why FOIA doesn't apply. And this didn't happen.
I don't see that in 2108.
It's NARA's regulations. Your Honor, I don't actually have the statute from me. I'm happy to send that to you in supplemental briefing. It's also in our briefs.
It just seems to me that the restrictions can be whatever the head of the donor agency thinks are proper restrictions, and the archivist, if he or she concurs with those restrictions, will respect those restrictions for as long as the period that's agreed upon. I assume there's some kind of negotiation that occurs between the head of the agency and the archives on this, but then once they go, pursuant to the agreement, the archives has to stick with that, and we respect that.
And, Your Honor,
Trump's FOIA, I guess that's the big issue, is this is a specific statute that speaks to the issue here and thus trumps or displaces how FOIA might otherwise apply.
And even if that is the case, Your Honor, when the National Archives sent these records to Congress,
right.
That March 2nd letter, it cited the citation that Ms. Cole just read, that language comes from the Freedom of Information Act.
Mm-hmm.
So the restrictions that were placed by Mr. Angelides when he deposited these records, those restrictions weren't citing FOIA. But when the records were sent to Congress from the National Archives did cite the FOIA restrictions. In fact, the language that Ms. Cole read was from the Freedom of Information Act 552B7 and B4. So what we have here is Mr. Angelides puts restrictions on these records, and the National Archives receives the records, then the National Archives, in its discretion, changes what those restrictions are when it transfers them back, when it transfers them to Congress.
Mm-hmm.
So what we have, interestingly, in the National Archives' own regulations, they're allowed to release records that have been deposited under the Privacy Act and to release records that have been deposited under the Presidential Records Act when Congress requests them, even without a subpoena. But there's no such similar regulation for records that are deposited under 2108. And I also want to draw your attention to the fact that these records were deposited under 2108, not 2118, which is the portion of the federal record, the portion of 44 USC 2118, governs the deposit of records from Congress. And that's another distinction to show that these records aren't from Congress back to Congress. These records are, sure, the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission was created in the legislative branch, but it's not Congress. And what we're discussing today is what NARA did. NARA's actions, when it possessed these records, when it received these records from the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission, and then modified those restrictions when it sent them back to, or when it sent them to Congress, we argue that those actions converted these records to FOIA records.
No questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.